you got out of college in 29?
Yeah, I got out of Syracuse University in 1929. I'd gone there on a scholarship, on a football scholarship, to with no particular career goal in mind. And didn't seem important to have a goal in those days. I'm talking about the late 20s. Because there was an overwhelming national prosperity, you know. And so all you had to do, it was assumed, was to get out of college, present your diploma, and begin collecting the rewards. Then along came 1929. Along came the great crash and the Great Depression. And everything changed. And I couldn't find a job. I had no proper equipment for it. I could do a few things. That's before the period of professional athletics, so I couldn't even turn to that.
What had you studied in college?
Whatever I could talk my way through. Sociology, Greek archaeology, stuff of that, philosophy, stuff of that kind. Things that I could, that I didn't have to do too much book work on. I avoided the hard things like calculus and trigonometry and things like that. That meant too much time chewing on the end of a pencil, so I went in another direction. And then along came the great crash, and I wasn't equipped for anything. I had, however, a reasonably good amateur theatrical background behind me. We'd had a very good society at Syracuse University, of which I was fortunate enough to be president for a couple of years, and we did good plays under excellent direction. And so my training as an amateur had been good. And when I couldn't land anything else, I finally followed the lead of a friend of mine who had done the same thing some years before. I began looking for work in the theater and found it. And I spent 10 years on Broadway with very good luck. I did plays that were quite successful, and I had a unusually high level of employment for a profession which is characterized by a low level of employment. I was in Three Men and a Horse, and then Having a Wonderful Time and Kiss the Boys Goodbye, Margin for Error, Fly Away Home. All of these plays had relatively extended runs. And by the end of the 30s, Hollywood began sending out signals for me. So I came out into the picture. My first picture was at Metro with Bill Powell, who I, sorry to see, passed away a couple of weeks ago at the very respectable age of 90-something, which is ironic because when I did that first picture, the making of the picture was delayed by, for a matter of two or three months, by the fact that he had to undergo one of the very first colostomies, you know, cancer of the bowel.
Yes.
And he wasn't expected to live more than a few months beyond that point. But he did recover. We did make the picture, and he did live another 40-odd, 45 years or so beyond the point at which he was supposed to die.
The operation was a success.
Yes, except to paint the patient eventually died. I came out and made that picture. Then I went back to New York and I did another play. And then when that closed, came out again and under contract to 20th Century Fox. And from that point, stayed on here. I began to convert during the days when radio became an important part of my professional activity. The show with Jack, for example, Jack Benny's show, and others which I did on a more or less regular basis, like Bob Hope and Phil Harris and Judy Canova, Parky Caucus.
You worked with Ann Southern, too, I think.
Ann Southern,
Maisie.
Yeah, Maisie. We did, so radio was very kind to me. And in that period, I started writing for radio because it was easy to do. They needed material badly, and I started writing for radio. And then when television came along, I had a lot of material that I had written and had sold, but which had reverted back to me, because in those days it was customary when network bought material, they bought it for two uses, for one use and a replay, and then it reverted back to you. So I had in my possession a very considerable body of material that was easily adaptable to television.
Mm-hmm.
Television was starving for material because the pay was low, prestige was non-existent, and I, having no pride, I had no compunction about converting that material to television. The only trouble was that the general level of creative talent available to television in those days, and I'm talking about the early 50s, the general level of directorial and writing talent and acting talent available to this bastard medium was not very high, and I was very unhappy with what happened with material that I had written. It deserved better treatment, I thought. So I made a stipulation, which was that whatever they bought from me, I had to direct. And thus, willy-nilly, I became a director.
Did that hamper your sales of the material you wrote then, by having to ride along with it?
No, it did. It did shortly afterwards, but not at first, because they were quite willing to accept me as director. But then I got too busy directing to have any time for writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had been my mistaken notion that I could keep a couple of careers going at the same time, like a juggler. Didn't work out that way, because television became too demanding. And the first thing you know, besides merely writing or directing or acting for television, I was now putting packages together with personalities. And it was in a period which was in which they were very receptive to material. And again, it was my great good fortune to, excuse me, like the surfers out at Malibu waiting for a good wave to catch, to ride in onto the shore. It was my good luck to catch a lot of good waves and to ride them all the way up. I got the Danny Thomas show. I had quite a few shows going for me before that, but then I chose to stick with the Danny Thomas show and to use it as a platform from which to launch other material. And from it, I launched the Andy Griffith Show, and then the Dick Van Dyke Show, and then the Gomer Pyle Show. And then, because my then partner, Danny Thomas, was so deeply involved in his own philanthropic work, his work on behalf of St. Jude Hospital,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We broke up the partnership, and I went into producing on with my own company, and we made I Spy and quite a few other things thereafter, which did well.
To say the least. To say the least.
And that's it. That's the whole thing in brief. I was very lucky. I did not. And this is all an answer to your question about whether my children followed in my footsteps. And the sum and total of what I've just told you is that I discouraged it because I didn't believe that this string of luck could necessarily, would in all probability repeat itself. It's like a man who goes to the craps table in Las Vegas and promptly has a roll of 12 or 13 or 14 passes and figures that's an easy way to make a living. Goes back the next day. I didn't figure I could continue throwing sevens and elevens forever. And I didn't think they could either. So I did not discourage their participation in the entertainment business, but I did nothing whatever to encourage it. As a matter of fact, we did all we could, my wife and I, to encourage their broadening their field. Mm-hmm. My son became first a lawyer and then an investment banker, and is now the president of the International Banking Activities, one of our largest investment banking companies, one of the largest in the world. As a matter of fact, he lives in London in considerable grandeur. And my daughter became a psychiatric social worker, which she continued to do for some years until quite recently. So that's the whole thing. You've got it in a nutshell now.
Well, now let's crack the shell a little bit and zero in on a few things. You have been fantastically successful with all of the things that you've done. What have you done that hasn't been so successful? What has been a really big flop? I mean, after you did the Dick Van Dyke Show and Andy Griffith and I Spy and Danny Thomas and Nate Gomer Pye and all these things, there must have been some that slipped through there that didn't quite work for you.
Yes, there were indeed, for a variety of reasons. Some, like one I did a thing based on James Thurber's material called My World and Welcome to It, which won all sorts of awards. You'll see in the other room, you'll see a couple of Emmys on the wall that it won in its brief career of 1 year. We won Sylvania Awards and Christopher Awards and so on. We canceled after the first year. Mm-hmm. We canceled because this was the beginning of the trend towards the juvenile audience, mm-hmm, that has taken over television. And the Thurber material, which I'm sure you're familiar with, was of too intellectual a nature for that kind of an audience. It was brilliantly satirical. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't quite what they wanted. What they wanted was Laverne and Shirley and
yes,
Mindy and Mork, or Mork and whatever.
That's but now that really may have not been a success on TV, but it certainly wasn't a failure if you've got a string of awards for it. And
well, I had
a valiant effort, I would say.
Had others, which for a variety of reasons. The one thing that I in everything that I did, even those things which did not enjoy a long run, like a show I did with Bill Dana, in which he played a bellhop in, mm-hmm, a hotel. Mm-hmm. That was a badly timed show because there was no receptivity at that time for a pseudo Latin American character. Mm-hmm. Character, and also it had a very difficult time spot. So I make no apologies for that. I make no apologies for the show I did with a young Italian by the name of Enzo Cherusco called My Friend Tony, where he and Jimmy Whitmore played a team of investigators where, based very loosely on the Nero Wolf format, in which one member of the team was the intellectual partner and the other one was the physical, mm-hmm, partner. And young Enzo, who's a brilliant and colorful young Italian actor, was extremely popular with... I made that in response to the demand for things for younger people, and mm-hmm, they promptly placed it in a time spot where it couldn't get that kind of an audience, 10 o'clock Sunday night, yeah, which is possibly, mm-hmm, the worst time in the whole week for the kind of audience for which it was designed. So I have no apologies for that. The only show about which I feel a degree of unease, guilt, what have you, is the one I attempted to do with Shirley MacLaine in England, association with Lou Gray, the thing called Shirley's World. And I feel I failed there because I did not maintain control of the show. I just I let the control of it slip out of my hands. Shirley is a very strong-minded person. And I was not there in London where we were making it all of the time as I would have had to be to maintain any firm control over it. I had to delegate a lot. And it was altered, and in other ways it was changed from what the concept had been, and I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm. Have you maintained strong control over all the years, over all these other shows that you've done? I mean, being more or less on the spot all the time?
One of the reasons for my present relative freedom of time, my ability to make round-the-world cruises and things, is that I have always enjoyed autonomy and still insist on it, even now when it's almost impossible to get, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
I had total autonomy for all of those years because from the beginning I had the backing of very powerful sponsors. General Foods and Procter & Gamble were my two principal customers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were overpoweringly strong, you know, even if the network didn't want a show. And they didn't. The network did not want Danny Thomas. They did not want Andy Griffith. They did not want Gomer Pyle. They did not want, yes, they did want Bill Cosby. That was a different network. My sponsors were strong enough to overcome the network resistance. They didn't want Andy Griffith and Gomer Pyle because Jim Aubrey at that time said that they'd had too much of these country atmosphere turd-kicking shows. You know,
CBS had Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction and all that sort of thing at the time.
So they had enough already, so he didn't want those. He didn't want Dick Van Dyke. He didn't want Dick Van Dyke because he said the show, there was no market for a show with show business atmosphere about show mm-hmm. business. If I could make him an insurance broker, that might be different. But as I say, I enjoyed autonomy due to the power and prestige of my mm-hmm. sponsors. And I exercised that autonomy, and then when the sponsors began to back out of the picture, as they did, as they backed away from total sponsorship and began to retreat to what they then called the magazine concept of buying a minute here and a minute there mm-hmm. and a minute somewhere else, and thus relinquished control of the show. When they began to do that, the network people stepped into the vacuum that had been created. And I could no longer exercise the same degree of control that I had had previously. And it was a little too late in life for me to begin to learn a new approach to making shows. You're following up on Jack Benny. There's a story that may be of value to you. I'll tell it for what it's worth. When I was working with Jack on his radio show first and then later making guest appearances from the television show, I was already becoming quite active in television, and Jack one day, lunch at the Brown Derby during the rehearsal break on a Sunday, said, "Hey, Shell, I've got an idea that make a good television show." And he told me an idea that would make indeed make a good mm-hmm. television show. And I said, "Yeah, that'd be fine, Jack. That'd be real good. Why don't you pitch it at the networks?" He said, "No, that's not my line of work." I said, "Well," he said, "it's yours. Take it. I give it to you." I said, "No, thanks. I'm not interested in it unless you come with it as at least an advisor, at least a friend of the court or whatever. And besides, if we had to submit it, I would want you to be the one who submitted it. It's your idea." So an appointment was made. And we went to the office of a network that shall be unnamed. And were ushered into the private office of the head of development for comedy material. And there was his entourage that assembled in the office, and after the amenities, the coffee and the rest, you know, Jack said, "Go ahead, Shell, tell him the story." And I said, "No, Jack, it's yours. You tell him." So he told him the idea, which was a good one. It was not unlike the concept that later became Laverne and Shirley, but it was more mature and had greater possibilities and greater scope. And the locale was to be one of these swinging single setups out, like mm-hmm. occur out here at the marina, you know. Great possibilities in here. And after about 10 minutes of eloquent Jack Benny delivery on the material, he finished and we sat back and we watched with satisfaction. And there was the exchange of glances amongst the people in the room, and then the head of development cleared his throat and said, he, by the way, was about age, I estimate age 28, 29, something like that. And he said, and I remember his words almost verbatim, not almost, I remember them just as he said them. He said, "Well, Jack, I think there's some good material there. I don't think it works the way you've got it, but I can tell you how to fix it." And Jack said, "I'd love to hear you tell me how to fix it, but I've got an appointment with my dentist that I've been looking forward to for weeks, so if you'll excuse me." And he left. So that's, and then that was the signal of an environment in which I could no longer enjoy the privileges that I had enjoyed. And when you're younger and poorer and more ambitious and more aggressive, you adapt to and put up with a lot of things that you mm-hmm. you have no... I have no motivation for that degree of tolerance any longer.
Well, it's not so difficult to learn new tricks if you're an old dog, but sometimes the young dog's trying to tell you what you should be doing. It's hard to accept that sort of thing from someone who doesn't have the depth or the background or the experience that you have. They have a position, and they think they know what should be, but they don't want to learn from experience.
Precisely. In other words, if I may paraphrase what you just said, no, it is not difficult for an old dog to learn new tricks. It's not difficult at all. But what is difficult is for an old dog to forget his good old tricks, mm-hmm. you know, and dismiss them.
The good ones, yeah.
The good ones. Yeah. No need to. No, doesn't benefit anybody to forget what you learned from George Burns and Jack Benny and Bob Hope and Fred Allen and George F. Kaufman and all the others, the greats of the past. I don't particularly want to forget what they taught me.
You spent a lot of time in the 40s in radio. You worked an awful lot. You were in the movies as well at the same time. And you were mostly playing the same types of roles in the movies. You were the gangster, the crook, the heavy kind of a person, weren't you?
Yes, but not by choice. It's mm-hmm. just the way the jobs came along.
It was the typecasting kind of a situation. Did you have a contract with one of the studios?
Yes, I was on the contract 20th Century Fox. Mm-hmm.
You said Fox. Did you also do some work at Warner's and some of their...
When my contract expired mm-hmm. At Fox, I freelanced with not only the majors, but the independents as well, at mm-hmm. Metro, at Universal, at Paramount, at Republic, at all of the studios.
So when they said, the producer said, this calls for a Sheldon Leonard type, they got Sheldon Leonard.
Yes, and everything was all right until the point when they started saying, this calls for Sheldon Leonard type, now who can we get? And they said, but Sheldon Leonard's available. He said, yeah, but not him. You know, so that's when I got my typewriter out.
And you started doing that.
Started amplifying my activities.
You said you wrote some things for radio that were moved into television. What things were they?
Well, I could tell you titles, they'd be relatively meaningless to you, but radio plays that I'd written for shows like Broadway Is My Beat mm-hmm. and First Nighter and shows of that kind in the half-hour format. Mm-hmm. I sold later to the General Electric Theater, to the Jewelers Showcase, and to other early TV series of that kind, the very early ones. The titles of them wouldn't mean anything to you.
But they were different series, anthology series for radio or for detective
That's right.
shows.
They were all of an anthology nature.
Did you write much comedy?
Yes, and that's when I began to become teed off at the fact that when it got to the screen, it wasn't funny. Because, listen, I hope this doesn't sound immodest. I don't mean it in a self-aggrandizing way, but I had had more experience and exposure than many of the people who were doing the medium at that time had the opportunity to get, and therefore they missed a lot of points. They failed to recognize where the comedy was or how to bring it out in many cases. And because of, I know this sounds smug, I don't mean it to, but because of my much greater exposure to it, you know, I was able to say, how did you expect it to be funny? You cut out the feed line, the build-up to it. Well, how did you expect it to be funny? You had him saying the punchline with his back to the audience, or what have you, whatever it might have been. And so I was eventually challenged to do it myself. If I didn't like the way they did it, I go ahead, do it yourself. And there were not too many directors doing comedy at that time. There were only a handful of us. There was Billy Asher and Mark Daniels and a few others and I. And so the demand for our services was constant and very great. And that's it. I had no more time for acting, no more time for writing. And the way I was working at that time, I was in effect doing most of the work that's allocated to a producer. This was because on the Danny Thomas show in particular, I was working with not only the star, but the owner of the show. Danny owned the show. And so when I wanted to make a change, I didn't have to go and ask anybody for the permission to do so, or I didn't have to send memos or seek authorization or anything like that. My authority was right there on the stage with me, and so we did whatever we had to do, and that way I was in effect producing the show as well as writing it. So it became relatively easy to make the transition to producing.
I'd like to talk about your role as an actor on radio, but we have to change the tape. We're talking with Sheldon Leonard, who made a career, I think, of saying, "Hey, bud," on the Jack Benny radio show. You were the racetrack tout on the Benny show for how long was that?
May I correct that? I was the tout, yes, but not the racetrack tout, because I never operated at the racetrack.
But you never were at the racetrack?
No.
You're always outside of the track.
I was touting him at something else. I'd meet him in a department store and tout him off of one elevator and onto another elevator. I'd meet him at a candy dispensing machine and tout him away from chewing gum to chocolate drops or what have you. You know, completely absurd things. But it was never from one horse to another horse. One show, I believe, I did meet him at the racetrack. But what I touted him on one table instead of another table, because the legs on this table were stronger than the legs on the other table. I don't know, a lot of nonsense. But Jack loved it, and he would break up whenever we did the spot. He would. He had great difficulty keeping a straight face, and he was probably the most supportive straight man that ever worked in the business. His great desire was not to score himself, but to see you score, to help you get the most out of your material. He was a precious man.
When did you start working for him?
I don't remember years. they all blended together. I would say that it was probably in the sometime in the late 40s.
In the late 40s?
Yes. Uh-huh. That's when I started to really get deeply involved in radio.
Uh-huh. Were you always the tout on his show? Did you ever do anything else with him?
On Jack's show? No, I never did anything else but the tout on Jack's show. On other shows, I did a variety of other characters mm-hmm. on a sustaining basis, but with Jack, he kept me in that particular niche, as he did with several mm-hmm. people.
Sure.
With Frank Nelson, for example, the one who was, yes. Mm-hmm. Frank always did that unctuous salesperson or what have you. Mel Blanc, well, Mel did a variety of characters. His basic value to Jack was in that Latin American character, Phil Harris was always Phil Harris.
Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm.
Jack did not scramble his characters around very much. Dennis Day.
Mm-hmm. You had probably a half a page of dialogue in a half-hour show. Would that be about it, the tout scene?
No,
in there?
It would be a two- or three-page uh-huh. scene as a rule.
It always worked so well, and people always remember you for that. I'm sure they do, don't they?
Oh, yes. People still mm-hmm. say hey, bud, for me, yeah. Something like that. You know.
Say it.
I forget.
You work with Bob Hope.
Yes. I played a character, I forget what we called him. I think we called him Soapy, but I don't remember. This character was always getting Hope into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
He was creating fist fights for him and all sorts of unlikely situations. And I did a similar character with Phil Harris on the Phil Harris show, which we tend to forget was a very successful radio show.
Was that marvelous radio show?
A good radio show, yeah. And I played the same kind of a character there. Then with Parker Carcass, I don't know if you wouldn't remember.
Was that Harry?
Back before you.
Harry Einstein?
Harry Einstein, uh-huh. yeah. I played a character called Orville Sharp, who preceded Norm Crosby. In that he, I believe, was one of the early characters, perhaps not the first, I've never researched it, but certainly one of the early characters to introduce the malaprop as a comedy mm-hmm. device. For example, the Mojave Desert would be referred to as Mo Harvey's Desert.
mm-hmm.
You know, and things of the vegetable, broccoli would be broccoli.
No.
Things
yeah.
of that kind. What Norm Crosby's doing now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then on the Maisie show, of course, I did her taxi driving suitor. And the same, practically the same kind of character, Judy Canova. And so on. So
your voice seems to lend itself well to the Damon Runyon type character or the lovable crook type.
Well, I did a good many Runyon-esque things because that was the era of Runyon. And I came from New York and I could emphasize my New York intonation as needed. So that plus the fact that the character I developed was compatible with Runyon. You see, there was a trick to Runyon, a trick which, when it was not recognized, resulted in a disaster, and when it was recognized, as in Guys and Dolls, as in Slight Case of Murder, as in a few other pieces of Runyon material, then these things went on to great success, but the trick was to play these underworld type characters as harmless slightly offbeat, basically rough diamond type of guys, you know, who had no harm in them. Nobody ever got killed in a Runyon show, you know. They talked about it, but nothing ever happened. I remember in Slight Case of Murder, the discussion about what to do with the body of No-Nose Cohen, which they had been keeping in the refrigerator, and it was spoiling the chef's chopped liver. So they said, well, let's leave it on. They had a discussion about whether they might leave it on the lawn of the doctor who had done a bad job on one of them, or maybe the judge who had sent so-and-so up for 30 days. But you never saw. There was no bloodshed in Runyon. There was no violence in Runyon either. So the trick in playing a Runyon character was to be credible as a gangster, a hoodlum, and still not have implicit in that credibility the possibility of violence. Mm-hmm. It was a trick. It was a trick that some people handled well. Alan Jenkins was very good at it. There were Frank McHugh was very good at it. George Tobias, others, names don't occur to me at the spur of the moment, but there were many who were good at it, and many for whom it didn't work. For instance, I made the picture Guys and Dolls. I did not make the stage show. In most respects, the stage show worked better than the picture did because the casting was closer to the Runyon concept than it was in the picture, in which they had to use star names in order to get it past the box office.
Yeah. They used Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra and some of the others. And on the stage, it was Robert Alda.
You Sam said that, Levine. I didn't.
Yeah. I said it, that's right. You've had an amazing career, and you've contributed an awful lot to the entertainment of this country and of the world. Now you're relaxing a little bit by traveling really around the world. Are there any new Sheldon Leonard projects on the agenda?
I don't encourage it. There may be. Granted certain circumstances, there may be.
If they give you complete control?
Yes.
And the money to do it? And
stay out of my way.
Stay out of my way, okay.
But I have done a few things. For example, I could not resist when they wanted me to make a two-hour picture with Bill Cosby. I couldn't resist that because I enjoy Bill. And we have a high level of mutual regard, and the prospect of going to southern Italy with him and staying there a couple of months working on a picture. Combination of Cosby's company and the good Italian food was too much for me to resist. And I have done, you know, other things, have gotten into various stages of the development, some fairly advanced stages, some rather primitive state. But since I don't encourage it, it doesn't demand too much of my time. For instance, I'm going in a week from week after this, I'm going down to Mexico for a couple of weeks of marlin fishing, which I couldn't do if I had my nose at the grindstone. Then sometime later in the spring, my wife and I will start out by visiting my son in London and wind up visiting all the other places we love, which we do periodically. We have kind of alternated our travel program so that on alternate years we do a cruise. A cruise is a very self-indulgent and luxurious experience, extremely luxurious. You're weighted on hand and foot, and you put on 20 pounds by the time you come home. But it is not as a travel experience goes. It does not compare with getting in a plane or a car or a train and going into the interior of the country. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. on a cruise, you hit the perimeter. You hit the port cities, yeah. Hong Kong, Bombay, and Singapore. Whereas when you get into the plane or get away from the coastline, then you really get into the heart of a country, into Delhi and Benares and what do they call Peking now? Beijing and so on. Kunming. So we, on alternate years, we make a land trip. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then alternate that with a cruise.
Well, I hate to see you give up that, so don't. But if a good project comes along and you can be 100% in control, I think we would be all the better off for it. Because television and radio, indeed, as well, needs people like you.
Very kind of you to say that.
Thank you very much for sharing this time with us, Sheldon Leonard.
Thank you for asking me. Yeah.